All right, so leadership advice. You want to be a good leader, you're in a bad environment. What do you do?
You want to be a good leader? Stop thinking it's about you. It's not about your aspirations. It's not about your goal and objective. It's about you subordinating yourself to the to your downliners and to your peers. It's about you interacting with your employees with the same level of deference and thoughtfulness that we used to do with kidnappers and hostage takers. That's the bottom line.
So you really, you worry about how they're going to react. I mean, you kind of get out of your own way, right?
Yeah, you get out of your own way, and you understand that when you go to that person, you tell them that the chief is pulling all take-home cars from all detectives, so you no longer have a company vehicle. Several of these people have had these company vehicles for 10 years. It's 10 years they haven't been paying for gas while they're coming to and from work, and now it's being pulled from them. That kind of message needs to be thoughtfully considered before it's being relayed. And so when you're going to relay that message, you're going to think, what are those negative opinions, assumptions, and impressions that those employees are going to have about me when I come in here to drop this bomb on them?
Yeah, so it ain't, you know, I'm going through the same thing. You know, I can remember one time when I was with the Bureau just before I left, one of the reasons why I think I was happy I got out when I did, they started cutting travel budgets. So we were, the only time an FBI agent at that time could fly business class is if you had to be someplace. You know, travel restrictions, if you got to fly for over 8 hours or something, then they make you, government rules are you got to stop off and spend the night, get a good night's sleep before you keep going. And but if you're working in kidnapping and it's a 20-hour flight, they'd fly you business class so that you could get there faster and sleep on the plane and arrive fresh. And I can remember, to save money, they took that away. And when one of the business, you know, one of the upper level executives at the Bureau was explaining it to me, and he was saying, like, look, even we don't get to fly business class anymore. And he thought that was going to make it okay for me.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, and I understand why he said what he said to you, because he didn't know any other way to soften that blow. And so he figures that if you looked at him as somebody with common ground,
then it might
be an easier pill to swallow.
But yeah, that common ground. People going like, I share your pain. I'm feeling it a little bit too. That nonsense.
Yeah. Nobody cares. Nonsense. Nobody cares.
The other side doesn't care. I mean, I don't know if you ever heard this joke. There's this really bad serial killer joke. I mean, it is a bad joke, and it's harsh. But, you know, unfortunately, it's a great example. You know, serial killer is dragging a little kid off into the woods, and it's dark and scary, and the little kid says, oh, my God, I'm scared. And the serial killer says, yeah, what about me? I got to walk back alone. But, I mean, as harsh as it is, that's a classic example. You know, what about me? Yeah. You know, I got to go through it, too. It's not as bad as you. But, you know, it's just really bad.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, that goes back to my earlier statement of it's not about you. You want to be better as a leader. Understand that it's not about you. Understand that you're in a unique position because.
Yeah. Well, yeah, you make more money. You make more decisions than the people you were loaning the boom on. I mean, one way or another, you're in a better position than they are, and there's no way that it's affecting you as much as it's affecting them. Plus, they're looking for you to guidance. You're in a power position. There are all these problems there.
Yeah.
This whole common ground, shared feeling stuff is just nonsense.
Yeah, and the common ground it comes off as disingenuous when you've got that dynamic at play where you've got a superior subordinate relationship. And you hit the nail right on the head. You can't tell me that this is affecting me the same way it's affecting you. You make 20 grand more than I do. So don't try to say that you and I are in the same boat. And that comes off as disingenuous. It comes off as transparent, faulty, and there's a certain lack of sincerity there. And all of those go to damaging trust. And it's not going to be this one instance of you passing a bad message in a bad way to your employees, but it's like the application of our skills in reverse. The cumulative effect of your bad communication with your employees is ultimately going to have you fail.
And it is cumulative, right? I mean, people that just keep storing up, no matter how much people try to forget, you know, it accumulates. It's like any other bad habit, right? You get fatter, you get bad nutrition, whatever it might be, right?
Yeah, or even a better analogy is the battered pet. At some point, the pet's going to get tired of you hitting on him. And he's going to turn around. He's going to bare his teeth. Well, that's tantamount to what happens in that superior subordinate relationship. You know, I cited one study in the book, the top three factors that people left bosses, and that's what they're doing. They're not leaving jobs. They're leaving bosses. Was their management style, condescending attitude, and a mean or bad temper.
People don't leave jobs. They leave bosses.
That's right.
If there's employee turnover, it's the boss's fault. That ain't the job's fault.
And as the labor force gets younger and younger, that's going to become more and more the case. These kids today, and when I say kids, I mean anybody younger than me, they're not sticking around anymore for that abusive behavior. They're not. They're just they're packing up and they're going to work for someone else.
So there's hope for the world. I mean, that's a good thing, right? Because that's going to make it a Darwinian process, and the companies that can't retain people, they deserve to go down the tubes.
You would think, you know, hopefully ego authority failure will stave that off. But the fear that I have is the people that need it most will read it the least.
All right. So let's say you want to do better for yourself right now. You're concerned you've been doing bad. You know, what are you telling me? What do you need me to do? How do I become more aware of this? How do I get better right now? I mean, how do I start to reverse this and get, you know, instead of a downward spiral, get an upward spiral?
So first, start off with your tone. Everybody that you talk to who's a subordinate knows the dynamic. They know you're the boss. You don't need to let it reflect in your tone.
What tone you're using right now?
The tone I'm using right now, the late night FM DJ voice, right? Because and there're going to be times when you're going to be switching in between tones, right?
Yeah.
When you're talking about the sequencing of delivering your message, right? So when you are beginning to speak with them, you're going to, like you're doing, you've got that half smile on your face. You're going to come across and put them in a more positive frame of mind, take away those negative emotions that they may have. Because I can guarantee you, if you're a boss, Chris, and you send out a calendar invite that we've got a meeting tomorrow afternoon at 3:00, all of us who work for you are going to be like, okay.
What's he going to bitch about, right?
Something's up because this is a meeting that he's scheduling within 24 hours. He never does this. There's something going on. Right. And it's a Sunday, and he wants to have this meeting, and it's an all-hands meeting. There's something going on. So automatically, I'm going to be amped up for this meeting. I'm going to be, what did I do? What is it that I didn't do?
Right.
And I guarantee you, everybody else that works for you is thinking the same thing, right? And so we're going to be coming into this meeting with a certain level of
anxiety
because there's uncertainty there. And right. when the situation is uncertain, people are uncomfortable. And when we're uncomfortable, one thing we want to do is to get comfortable again as soon as possible.
All right. So my job as a boss, try to get them comfortable so they could chill out a little bit.
Exactly. Because you've got a message that you want to send, and you want them cognitively nimble enough to hear that message.
And there's the issue for leaders, right? Because if you're increasing their anxiety, they've lost their ability to be cognitively nimble.
Yeah. Yeah. They've lost their ability to focus. They've lost their ability to process. And as a result, the negatives that they view you through are going to be clouding their ability to think about and absorb what you're saying.
Ah, right. And, yeah, all right. So you need them thinking, right? It's important. You got to have them think. So what do I do? What do I do? Besides tone of voice, I send out this message. How do I keep them from tossing and turning all night, waiting for the meeting the next day?
How do you keep them from tossing and turning, waiting for the meeting the next day?
Yeah. So you just don't send the message out at all, or what?
Maybe don't send the message. Well, the message should be sent out with probably an accusations audit in the message. The accusations audit, where you're labeling that negative beforehand. You know, I know this is going to sound horrible. I know this is going to catch you guys off guard. It's going to make you a little anxious. There's a meeting scheduled tomorrow at 3 p.m. on Zoom. And here's the dial-in instructions. And just leave it at that.
Simple. Now, simple. Yeah, yeah.
You know, back in my old job, when I was running the team, we assisted with an event. And the primary that we had on the phone is the one that was on the phone. Deal got closed, so to speak. And she did a remarkable job. In fact, it was probably some of the best use of the skills that I had heard in my 20 some odd years of being involved in the discipline. And the powers that be came to me, and they too thought she did a tremendous job. And they said, we want you to write a letter of commendation for her performance. And my response was, no, I'm not going to write a letter of commendation just for her. Because while she was the focal point of the incident, there was a team of no less than 11 other negotiators who were in the background supporting her in the role of coach, supporting her in the role of intel gatherer, supporting her in the role of scribe or situation board representative. And so it supports the adage. You want to go fast, go by yourself. If you want to go far, go as a team. You're not always going to be able to have a team with you. I understand that. But when you can control it, you should not go into the room. You should not get on the call without at least a wing person to go with you. Invariably, things are going to get by you. If you are the primary negotiator, you're the primary contact with the other side, there are things that are going to be said that you are going to miss. And it's comforting to have someone in the room, someone on the phone with you, someone on that video call to help you. So we'll give you an overview of what it looked like from a HNT, a hostage negotiation team perspective, and you'll be able to see or at least be exposed to some of the elements that you can pull out and plug and play with in your next negotiation or difficult conversation. Some of the key terms we're going to talk about: negotiation operations center. You'll hear me refer to it as the NOC, and that is the location from which the primary engages the counterpart, or the location in which that slide is messed up. The location in which the negotiations are being conducted from. The primary negotiator is the sole communicator with the other side. The coach or the secondary negotiator is the direct link to the primary, or between the primary and the rest of the team. Team leader is the person who has overall responsibility for the effort. The scribe takes the notes, and the situation board person collects and posts relevant information. When we talk about a NOC, we're talking about, in the old world, any office or conference room. It doesn't really matter. Any office or conference room, but you want to stand up a NOC when the time calls for it. And right now we're in COVID, so the time is calling for you to set up a NOC. Why wouldn't you? It puts you at a distinct advantage when off camera, within a room, there are people that are occupying different spots on the team in order to make the primary's job that much easier. You know, a lot of the feedback that we got in the survey revolved around keeping people in their lane, not having people interject when they're not supposed to, It revolved around negotiating within the negotiation to make sure that our goals and objectives are aligned. And so when we start to look at the positionings within each team, as you prepare for your negotiation and you start to put people in their respective spots, that is the time to discuss exactly what their roles are, what's expected of them, and how the flow of the conversation should go with the counterpart. Setting it up on a phone call or for a Zoom call. Now, will all of you be in the same room when this call is taking place? Probably not in today's climate because we're scattered all over the place. But that doesn't preclude you from assigning people to this position if you have the numbers available. So when we start talking about a scribe taking notes, the scribe can be across the country in another room, logged into the call. The situation board person could be in another room in the same building, logged into the call. Now, what's the difference between the person on the SIP board providing information and intel when they are remote? There are various methods or there are various technologies that are out there that can assist you with that. Slack, your standard text message, WhatsApp, whatever the case may be, where you can relay the information. So remotely or in the same room, the rules and the roles rarely change. All right, so your minimum team configuration, Brandon alluded to this earlier. You at least want to go in with one person. We call them the coach. The coach is there to support, direct, and provide encouragement to the primary, who actually has actual voice-to-voice contact with the other side. So, specifically, your primary maintains direct contact with the person on the other side of the table. They are there to start that process of tactical empathy. They are there to help diffuse emotions and the negative dynamics associated with the conversation. If you're in a conversation where I want or I need or in your head or in the head of your counterpart, the negative emotions, negative dynamics are going to be present, and the primary is the one person who is going to be used to diffuse those negatives on the other side. They're also there to gather information. There's information that your counterpart has that you're unaware of and that you will only uncover when you get into a dialogue. So the primary is responsible for remaining genuinely curious. Remaining genuinely curious means he is or she is on a continuous hunt to gather information, to pick up those black swans. And the primary facilitates problem solving and gets us to a resolution or an agreement. The coach monitors, directs, and supports the primary. First and foremost, are they going to remain emotionally neutral? Are they going to not give rise, or are they not going to rise to meet an attack with anger or with an attack themselves? It starts with their voice. It starts with their ability to control their tone. Their volume, their cadence is all very important. And when emotions are high, our inner voice will tend to betray our outer voice. And the coach is there to make sure that the primary basically stays seated when emotions start to get elevated. More importantly, the coach is going to listen for opportunities to label important dynamics that may be missed by the primary. As I mentioned earlier, the primary is so engaged in the conversation, there are things that are going to go by and they are not going to pick up on it. And that's where it is important for the coach to step in. And Brandon, while I'm thinking about it, I want to pass it over to you. Because I want you to give a brief snapshot of OMB and how important, you don't have to go into the whole thing, but how important it was for you to act as a coach on that particular negotiation?
Yeah, sure, sure. Not a problem at all. So there's actually a case study that we do for our bigger training sessions, you know, the 7-8+ hour training sessions. And this case study is based on a negotiation that Chris and I were in directly, a Black Swan negotiation with a over a government contract. And we had to work with an intermediary, right? What we would call in law enforcement a TPI, third party intermediary, which was basically a contractor that was between us and the government entity that we were working with in this case. And so early days in Black Swan, so Chris was our primary negotiator, right? He's the main guy. I am working as the coach. And so to Derek's point from earlier, the primary negotiator doesn't actually have the ability to pick up all the information that is happening at the table. And there's plenty of data out there. I won't bore you with the numbers, but the reality is we know based on scientific data, fMRI studies, all these things, that the working brain does not actually have the capacity to absorb the amount of information that is coming off a human being at any given moment. And the ratio is basically 3-to-1. Right? Like the person is giving off at least 3 times as much information as you actually have the ability to pick up, which is why it's one of the reasons it's so important to have that coach, because when you're not worried about what you're going to say next, it actually clears up part of your brain to pick up more information. So we're in this negotiation. We thought we had poor assumptions going in, right? We had a poor hypothesis that we didn't test. We thought that our relationship with the government entity we were going to do business for was strong enough that they told the TPI, the intermediary, that, look, we love Black Swan. We've had their training already. We want more of it. Make the deal because we want these guys. And in addition to that, we do not do the same type of training that this intermediary already does for this government entity. So we come in, and I'll never forget, the first thing out of Chris's mouth when we got on the phone was, we are really looking forward to this partnership. There were also 2 people on the other side. They happen to be women. Not that that matters. I just can still hear her voice very clearly in my mind. Her response to that was, you guys aren't partners. You're subcontractors. And the way that she spit that out, I will never forget. I mean, that is something that is burned in my memory. Instantly, we're off on the wrong foot because this argument almost ensued right from Jump Street. And as we're working our way through, what I am hearing is an underlying theme is they are terrified that we are going to steal their client from them. And then in addition, we haven't earned the spot to work with this client. And so I jump in initially with a label and say, it sounds like you're most worried about us coming into your territory. And there's this long pause on the other end. And I wait a second and immediately jump into an accusations audit. That's, you guys have done a lot of work to get to this position. We have fallen out of the sky and have come at you from left field. And basically doing everything I can to say, look, this is your barbecue and it tastes good. And that was the moment that was actually the pivoting moment that got us to resolution. We went from arguing over who actually deserves to be in this position to them agreeing to all the terms that we wanted, which in this case, as many of you will probably not be surprised by, was focused on how we're going to split up the cash. And we instantly went from a 65-35 split to an 80-20 split with no fuss because we were able to recognize that. And so the reality is you're going to run into problems at the table. You're going to have counterparts that are going to have issues that they do not overtly express with their words. And that is the job of the coach, to be able to pick up on those dynamics in the moment and then shine a light on them through the use of a label. And exactly as it's written out on the slide, looking for opportunities to label dynamics that have been missed. And that said, the last thing I'll add to this is when you are organizing your team, it's probably best to have your most skilled negotiator be in the coaching position. We've had a lot of discussions about this, and the reality is, who's the most important person at the table? The primary is very important, but they're probably a 1A. Your coach is there to manage the entire situation from end to end. What's happening with your scribe, your sit boards? If your primary hits a road bump, there's somebody's got to be there to bail them out, and you can't get caught thinking about stuff. You got to be able to give an answer right away, and that's where the coach comes in. The person that is always consistent, does not get rattled, fully versed in the skills, and then also has the wherewithal to jump in with the right verbal observation at the right time.
Perfect. And so the other point I wanted to make along with that is, why did you have to jump in? Because we were missing something on the other side. True. But the other reason you had to jump in is that Chris went into this conversation thinking that the skids had been greased. And not only was he caught off guard by the fact that the skids had not been greased, but he was also attacked immediately as the conversation got underway. And those two elements provoked a negative emotional response on Chris's part, one of the most gifted negotiators on the planet. And the negative emotions and dynamics shut him down. It shut him down to the point where he was missing what was being said, and that's where Brandon came in. So don't think that you're versed in the Black Swan skills, and so therefore you're immune to the negative emotions and dynamics that come in as a part of a difficult conversation, because as Chris demonstrated in this case, you are not. So providing organization. We're talking about assessing and developing the negotiation strategy. Now, the coach is not going to do this in a vacuum. He's going to do this in the moment by himself, but in preparation, this is going to be incumbent upon everybody who calls themselves a part of the negotiation process and or team. But in the moment, he or she is providing immediate short-term assessment and responses that the primary should utilize as needed. Those two words are very important, as needed. Brandon said that as a coach, you should probably be the most capable of negotiators within your organization or on your team. With that comes a responsibility for you to keep your mouth shut when it's time to keep your mouth shut. People in the coaching position will often want to inundate the primary with, say this next, say that next, say this next, say that next. And that's done by way of hand signal or sticky note or whatever form of communication you've come up with. But I've seen it time and again. I caution my team, don't overcoach your primary. You put them in the position to do the job, allow them the latitude to do the job. So as needed is critical. And you're also thinking ahead, anticipating what's that other side going to do or say? How is the other side going to react? The coach, not in a vacuum, but along with the rest of the team, is responsible for making sure that the primary has been properly prepared before going in. We've got a one sheet on our website. Take advantage of that one sheet. Talk to your primary about anticipated issues. Where are we going to go? If this, then that. What are the themes and strategies that we're thinking about utilizing? Prompts and scripted dialogue, again, as needed. Your prompts, or your scripted dialogue is going to take place prior to, your prompts are going to take place in the actual heat of battle, for lack of a better term. And they're responsible for role play. role playing is a critical importance. It does not make sense for you when you have time to prepare for a call. Sometimes you're thrust into a call that comes out of the blue and you find yourself in the middle of a negotiation with little time to prepare. If you have time to prepare, you should make as a part of that preparation process a role play. Don't let the first time you try to throw a down and out football pass in the Super Bowl. Make sure that you've practiced it over and over again. Your coach will have a good idea as to what the counterpart is like, will have a good idea as to all the negative opinions, assumptions, and impression that the counterpart has about you, and therefore can assume the role of the counterpart pretty good. And so it's important to role play it out. It's important to set your knock up just the way you would as if the actual conversation is going to take place. Rehearse every single role. All of this is going to be new to anybody on your team. So, you know, you're going to have to tell your scribe, this is exactly where I want you to do. This is where you're going to stand so that you are off camera if it's a Zoom call. You're in the wings. And we're going to keep the noise down. And when there's something on that situation board that needs to be addressed, all you're going to do is point to it. And it's the coach's job to understand which one you're pointing to and then convey, relay the information to the primary. And we talked about the emotional control to make sure that the primary stays seated during the course of the conversation. Keep the primary focused on the goal and objective. Continually assess the dynamics between the two parties. You're removed from the conversation, so your assessment is going to be a lot clearer than what an assessment would be coming from the primary. This is of critical importance. Your coach is the primary conduit between the primary and the rest of the team. Stay in your lane. If you are a sit board rep, you're working the sit boards, that is your job. Your job is not to go directly to the primary with information that's relevant. Your job is to get it to the coach or the team leader, and the coach or the team leader will provide it to the primary. All of you guys who are not actually on the call, you're not actually engaged in dialogue, are going to come up with ideas or strategies that you think are important, and you're going to want to insert yourself into the conversation. Understand the impact that that has on the primary if they were to have multiple sources of information coming in at them all at the same time. Half of their brain is going to be offline when they're supposed to be engaged with the other side to determine what the true motivations are behind a statement or a question. Half of their brain is offline because they're trying to process incoming information from the outside world. So to keep that funneled in the proper direction, it should go to the coach before it goes to the primary. And how do we do most of our conversations during these negotiations? Hand signals or sticky notes?
Joe put in the chat, what if there's a mediator between rooms? And he said tone is gone, correct? And that's a good question, Joe. When you're using a mediator, it's kind of hard to modulate tone because you can't really control what that person does. But I can tell you, if you have a good mediator and they're between rooms, however you give them that information, they will probably use a similar tone when they're giving it out. So if you're angry and you give them whatever you're saying in anger, when they take it to the other side, it's going to come across angry because they're going to emulate that tone. One way you can test this is with kids, because when you talk to them, whatever tone you're using, especially if you have young children, pay attention to them when they're by themselves and they're making their little stuffed animals interact or whatever. They will use the exact same tone you use to them when they're talking to other people. So tone does carry through in different ways. So just be careful. No matter who you're talking to, what tone, yes, Joe. So they would mirror the tone. And usually that does happen, especially if you have a good mediator. And usually those people aren't hired as mediators if they're not going to try and be fair and put things exactly like they're supposed to be. So just be careful. Whatever tone you're using to that person is the tone they're going to carry forward with what they say. It's not an ideal situation because you do lose that bit of control, but you can kind of mold it a little bit by how you put the information out there.
Now, great, great add there, Sandy. And so I'll add a couple thoughts. And the first thought I'm going to add is going to sound extremely insulting. And that is simply, first instinct for me personally, right? I'm asking this more so from a personal side. First instinct is get rid of the mediator. My first negotiation would be to remove the mediator, because the mediator is a sign of our two parties can't come together amicably and work this out. So we need a bouncer between us so that we don't strangle each other in the boardroom together, right? And that's really what a mediator means. And so that's insulting. That's why a mediator's there, because we can't figure out how to get along with each other, so we need somebody to mediate. That's my first reaction. Get rid of the mediator. And then get your negotiation one sheets out and start working really closely with the rest of your team on how you're going to interact with the other side. Starting probably with what your tone sounds like, right? But that's, let's say we got to deal with the mediator, right? We got to use this TPI, third party intermediary between us. First thing is, got to have a sit down with the mediator. Separate sit down with the mediator about how you want your message translated. The reality is, in negotiation is also with the mediator. Now that you've brought another party in, now you got to negotiate with this person and negotiate with the people over there at the same time. And I think a lot of us lose sight of that when the mediator gets, because like, oh, it's just professional. We just tell them what we want, and they'll shape it and mold it and give it to the other side properly. Like, I don't count on it, right? I wouldn't count on it. So separate negotiation, I'm also a very big testament of, you tell a mediator something and they got to translate that message, I'd look them dead in the eye and say, how are you going to say it? What are you going to sound like when you deliver this message to the other side? I want to hear you say it, right? And then like, okay, a couple tweaks, right? Or, you know, again, how does this look? How do we make sure that we get the message across with the way that this sounds when you deliver it, right? Make the mediator the problem solver, just like you would anybody else. How's it going to sound? Would it be impossible for me to hear you actually say it out loud? Okay. Sounds a little condescending. How do we make it so they don't react adversely to that? Okay, give it to me again, right? And so you got to go through that with your mediator. Feel free to do that. They work for everybody in the room. They're taking a cut of everybody's piece. Might as well sit them down and walk them through. But great question, because we work through third parties. That happens, right, in the business world.
As far as notes are concerned, be cautious about inundating the primary with a bunch of sticky notes. I've got pictures. I should have loaded some into this PowerPoint, but I've got pictures and training exercises and actual exercises or events where I take a picture at the end of the event of all the sticky notes that are on the table in front of the primary. And some of them are so high that if the primary were seated at that desk, you would not be able to see much above the bridge of their nose because of the number of sticky notes that were put before them during the course of the event or the exercise. Keep the notes to a minimum. They should be short, handwritten, neat, timely, and organized. I emphasize timely because sometimes people are throwing notes in there and that portion of the conversation has passed us by. We've already resolved that issue, or we've answered that question, we've moved to something else, and then a note comes in trying to take us back. So make sure that they're also timely. Some of the pre-developed prompts that you may want to consider are your accusations audits, your calibrated questions in order to shape thought, your how questions on implementation. My favorites are, you know, your asking labels. It seems like you have a reason for saying that. Seems like you have a reason for asking. Very appropriate to put in front of a primary in the moment. Here's some other examples. Time travel. When you said X, what did that mean to you? Your phases of no. You know, I'm sorry, that just doesn't work for us. Would it be a bad idea if I shared with you what we were thinking? A no-oriented question to protect the autonomy of the other side. Other no-oriented questions, how am I supposed to do that? We just can't do that. And then confrontation. When you want to confront counterproductive behavior on the other side, you hit them with an I message, which is when you, I feel, because. Moving on to the team leader. This is the person responsible for the overall management of the negotiation effort. This is a senior team member. Doesn't have to be an executive or a leader within the organization, but this is somebody who's been around the block and who can correctly guide the subordinate elements of the team. This is the person that provides that status assessment and recommendation to senior management, particularly in negotiations that are not one-time transactions. They are going to be multiple hits before an agreement is made. This is the person that goes into the senior executives and say, this is where we are. This is what we think is going on, and here's how I recommend that we proceed. The team leader, when you're together, it's not going to be as important when you're remote, but when you're together, the team leader is responsible for insulating that knock, insulating that primary and coach from unnecessary distractions, keeping the knock as pristine as possible. They're listening off in the wings for anything that might come up that will be useful in strategy development, especially when there are natural breaks in the conversation. We're going to break for lunch. We'll reconvene at 2 o'clock. That is a perfect time for you guys to start your strategy development when a natural timeout has been called in the conversation. Your scribe just maintains a record of the dialogue. It does not have to be a verbatim listing of everything that was said, only what's germane, what's important. Keep it short and concise. You know, a simple notation, at 10:05, counterpart said X, our response was Y. And then finally, there's your situation board rep. And this is the person that maintains significant information about the conversation on whiteboards, butcher block paper, dry erase, whatever you want to call it, for team consumption inside of the NOC. Now, in a remote situation, I still recommend you putting up that butcher block, or you're using that white paper or that whiteboard or the cling sheet. But the reliance and conveyance of that information is going to have a little bit of a hiccup in it because you are remote. But again, technology will help to combat that. Now, I've laid out several roles that need to be filled. Real world, you may not have that many people involved, which means the coach is going to be responsible for everything else that is needed. So the coach may be also your sit board guy. The coach may also be your scribe. The coach may also be your team leader. You may get on a Zoom call and establish your knock, and there's only two people in there, the primary and the coach. That's okay. I just wanted you guys to have a snapshot of the roles that you should fill if you have the luxury of the adequate number of personnel. Brandon, before I press through with situation boards, observations, questions, suggestions.
Well, my first thought is not, I think you're very much on point and where we're going with this, excuse me, is cohesiveness on your side starts with team structure. That's the beginning. And so if you don't have team structure in place where everyone stays in their lanes, especially during an interaction, but you're working on something else further down the line and you can't figure out why we're not on the same page, it's because the team structure is not solidified yet. I got to admit, what I'm very encouraged by is several of you have a great team structure in place, it sounds like, just based on some of the comments we're getting in the chat. You've got some designated roles, which is great. And so stick with that. But as far as staying in the lanes, what comes to mind, a metaphor, Derek is a former basketball coach, right? You saw the pictures earlier in the presentation of him knelt down talking to one of his players. And so there's a lot of translations to that. First of all, who's likely the most skilled person on that team that Derek was coaching? The reality is it's Derek, because he's passing the knowledge off to the people that have to execute. And so direct translation to the negotiation table. Also, if you're not familiar with basketball, there's point guard, shooting guard, all the way up to center, right? And at the lower levels of basketball, they refer to them as 1 through 5. And so the easiest way to think about it is the shorter you are, the lower your number is, the higher you are, the higher your number is, right? You're tall, you're probably playing a 5, you're a center, or you're a power forward at the 4. And if you're shorter, quick, smart, floor general, you're probably playing the 1 or the point guard. Now, the reality is it's the point guard's job, or it's the number 1's job, to bring the ball up the floor. The center or the 5 does not ever bring the ball up the floor. And so if you got people out of position that are bringing the ball up the floor when it is not their job to do so, you got problems on the team structure. And so really that's where it starts, setting the team in place, because you can't expect people to play their role if they're not fully aware of what that role entails. And so clarity along those lines is always where you got to start.
In preparation, and I've seen a couple of recent chats go up, and so this kind of relates to their comment and or question. Now you have a snapshot of what the roles look like. You can play with this any way you want. The more you have, the better. My initial idea was to increase my team number to 15 and split that team in half into an A and B team, so that A would have the first 2 weeks of the month on call, and then B would have the last 2 weeks of the month on call. But the reality is it never really worked out like that, because, you know, half of A team was out of town or otherwise incapacitated when a call went out, and I'd wind up borrowing from the B team. And now, or when I left and the call went out, everybody who was available were mandated to respond. And did I get all 15 people there? There were one or two occasions when I got the entire team there, all entire 15 people, and all 15 of those people were put to work, because it just makes everything that much easier. There's something to be said about the more the merrier. Now, preparing people for these positions is going to take some training. It's going to take some pre-dialogue discussion. And particular importance has to be put on this is how the conversation is going to unfold. Your team leadership has to establish a chain of command when it comes to getting information to the primary. Because if multiple people are talking on the phone call, the chances that you have divergent messages is great. And all of a sudden, I jump into the phone call to save the day, and it's not where Brandon intended to go. And now I've created a fissure, if you will, on our side of the table. Now it looks like not everybody is in accord, not everybody is in agreement, and it puts us at a disadvantage. Certainly, if for no other reason than the optics are bad. So, pre-dialogue. Set the stage. This is how we're going to execute. Scribe, this is your lane. This is all you're permitted to do. You want to convey something to Brandon, do it during one of the timeouts, get a note to the team leader, who can then get it to Isaac, who will then, if it is appropriate, get it to Brandon. And be steadfast. As Isaac said, be disciplined in how you convey the message and how the accountability factor. How are you going to hold these people accountable? Now, this challenge involves a negotiation within the negotiation, or a negotiation prior to the negotiation. Some of the feedback that we got for the survey question was, what happens when you got people on your team who aren't Black Swan trained? Well, when you tell them this is how the negotiation, this is how the dialogue, this is how the conversation is going to unfold, that's probably going to be news that they're not going to want to hear, because they've been trained by another negotiations company, and or they've been trained at another university that looks at negotiations in a different manner than the Black Swan Group does. So you telling them this is how the negotiation is going to go is going to be news that they're not going to want to hear. So before you share that with them, you set it up with an accusations audit where you're going to tell them, I know you probably think that I'm being a know-it-all. You probably think that I don't have a lot of experience, as much experience as you do in this area. You may think that some of the ways that you have been instructed to conduct the dialogue is superior to what I'm going to do. You may think that I'm trying to impose my will, and you probably think that I'm trying to showboat for the executives. And you let it sit. And you ask them, what's your vision on how this dialogue is going to be conducted? Are you against sharing that with me? And get them to verbalize. Here's what I was thinking. Here's what I had in mind. You label, mirror, paraphrase those positive things, those things that support where you want the conversation to go, that support your position. And then to reinforce them, of course. And then no oriented question. Are you against me sharing with you what our vision is, what my vision is? And then you lay out exactly, this is how we're going to do it. Brandon's going to be the primary. His job is going to be X, Y, and Z. He will carry the message. He is the sole mouthpiece for the conversation. Isaac is going to be the coach. He's going to support Brandon. Shelly is going to be the team leader. This is her responsibility. Joanne is going to be the scribe. This is her responsibility. Frank is going to work the situation board. This is his responsibility. What about that doesn't work for you? Hash it out. But at the end of the day, you're going to draw your line in the sand as to how you guys are going to execute as a team. But just like you would in any other negotiation, you got to lay the groundwork first and then put out your mandate or your dictate as to how the execution is going to occur.
Could you tell us a little bit about what hostage negotiator leadership, and that abbreviated is HNL, hostage negotiator leadership. What does that mean, and why is it a great framework to build in a leadership position?
All right, so that's a good question. So the framework, HNL framework, is based on a simple premise that was taken from the world of hostage negotiation, and that is, ask yourself what your work environment would be like if you treated your direct reports with the same level of deference and subordination that hostage negotiators do hostage takers. What if you treated every difficult conversation that you engage in the workplace like a hostage negotiation, where you are the negotiator? That's, in a nutshell, the framework of hostage negotiator leadership. You have a responsibility to the organization, and sometimes that responsibility to the organization trumps your responsibility to your direct reports. And in hostage negotiator leadership, we're always focused on what the impact is going to be when I make my ask. What is the impact going to be when I have the conversation prior to making my ask? How is that going to impact the other person? What negative emotions and dynamics are going to be produced as a result of the difficult conversation? That is the way that we manage all of our hostage negotiations. Our ultimate goal as hostage negotiators is to get the people out. get the bad guy to release the hostages, and then ultimately surrender himself or herself. Now, we know that's our goal going in, but we never lead with that goal on the initial conversation with the hostage taker. That goal, that objective is subordinate to what is going on with them. In other words, what's their frame of reference? What is their view of the world? What negative opinions, assumptions, or impressions are they going to have about the message that I'm going to relay to them? And how can I best mitigate those negatives? Because the mitigation of those negatives is your first step at employing tactical empathy. And that's what's missing in a lot of our professional or corporate workspaces, is a healthy dose of tactical empathy, understanding that it's not about you, understanding it's not about your goal, it's not about your objective, your case in chief, your ask, at least for the first 75-80% of the conversation. It's about the other side. And so hostage negotiator leadership relies heavily on tactical empathy, primarily because of the power that it has when it comes to reciprocity. As a manager, as a boss, if you display that level of tactical empathy first, you will generate more collaborative responses from your team. And that's what we're ultimately trying to do. Create an environment where the team members are doing something that you're asking them to do, not because you ask them to do it, but because they want to. Because at the end of the day, anybody anywhere on the planet would do anything for you if they trust you, if they trust you have their best interests at heart. And so that's the environment that we're trying to create in the workspace. And that goes back to my earlier question, how much better would your workspace be if you were to conduct yourself just like that, as a hostage negotiator dealing with a hostage taker?
Absolutely. That was a great explanation. And regarding the hostage negotiator leadership framework, Henrik, you can unmute your mic and ask your question to Derek. Henrik, can you hear us? Looks like you might have some technical issues. Could you unmute your mic, Henrik? Let's try it again.
Doesn't look like it.
Okay.
That's a shame, too, because I knew he had something. Henrik always comes in hot with the questions.
Well, let me see if I can read it. Give me one second. Henrik says, "Hi, Derek. Great to be here listening to you. I have a question regarding how to integrate H&L in a specific case." Let's try it again, Henrik. Can you unmute your mic? Let's see. Okay, we have another question, but I will say, Henrik, if you can exit out of the app and come back in, we'll allow you to ask the question again. Our next question is from Amber. Amber, I'll bring you up on stage. Perfect. Amber, could you unmute your mic and you can ask Derek a question?
Okay. Can you hear me now?
We can.
Is my internet connection? Okay, my internet connection is a bit slow. I have a question from a friend who's asking, how to deal with assertives who are giving out orders, immediately taking charge when they first meet. Practically, they immediately start ordering them around. And it's one of those classical situations where you think of all of the great things you could have said only long afterwards. How to deal with people who assume control, take charge of the encounter. Practically, it's kind of like a pretty overt bullying situation, let's say. Avoiding meetings with people is not always possible. With these kind of people is not always possible, especially in a work environment. So how do you, like, even referring to ego authority failure, how do you handle a situation like that?
All right, so let me ask you a question before I answer, Amber, and that is, when you are subjected to that kind of behavior, what does that do for you? Emotionally, internally, cognitively, what does that do for you?
Okay, knowing this person, it probably causes her to freeze. Me personally, when people do that to me, it depends on the situation. It can either trigger an angry response, or else I personally go into deferential mode. I switch on my customer service hat. It's not always the case, of course. Mm-hmm. However, this person in particular is often bullied at work like this, and has been trying to deal with the situation best they can. They just don't have many techniques down.
Yeah, understood. So the first thing that I would recommend that you share with them is, we're always, with the Black Swan method, we're always on the hunt for the motivating factors. What's driving the behavior? We get so wrapped around the axle that this person comes in and throws their weight around and gets bullied and takes over the show on every project that they get involved in, and how that makes us feel, that we don't look at what the driving motivation is behind the behavior. For every behavior, for every statement, for every question, there is a reason behind it. And your challenge, your friend's challenge, is going to be, how do I uncover what that real reason is? Part of that is going to be intuitive. Part of that you're going to pick up simply because your gut is telling you. If you're willing to listen, that's where most people fail, is that they're unwilling to listen to their subconscious. Your brain is a powerful supercomputer. They've been trying to duplicate the computing process of the brain in desktop and laptop computers for decades, and they cannot do it. Your brain, your conscious brain processes probably 40 bits of information per second. Your subconscious brain, i.e. your intuition, your gut, processes 20 million bits of information per second. There's a lot of data coming at you from the other side that's going to scream at you what's going on with them. That's where your frame of mind needs to be, is determining what is motivating the behavior. The bullying is incidental. The taking over of the conversations and being very aggressive is incidental. There's something that's driving that. And so I know you're a third party in this conversation, but I want you to use your supercomputer, Amber, and tell me, when you're subjected to the person that's coming at you with both barrels and they're being aggressive, they're being bullying, they're bullying you, they're trying to push you around the room, assert their authority, impose their will, what do you think is going on with them internally?
They probably feel threatened. They probably trying to take over control, because they see they're afraid that you will maybe outshine them or something of the sort. Like, especially if it's a situation where it's a boss dealing with a millennial, like an older boss dealing with millennials, for example. That's one thing I've noticed. Very often these people, they have a very, very little self-esteem, and they see the other person as, like the other day with Sandy, we're talking about the body posture. Probably in my talking right now, because I'm crouched over again, I'm coming across as much weaker than what I actually am if I would assume the proper body posture. So there's a lot of that in the mix.
All right. All of that, I never said that I was worried about being outshined. I never said that I was worried about having something taken from me. But those are all signals that you picked up based on this scenario as presented. That is your subconscious brain telling you, this is the data that I'm picking up from the other side. What is the best way to manage that person in that situation is to identify and verbalize what you just told me. They're being threatened. Fear of loss is the single biggest driver of human decision making and behavior. What you just described for me was a fear of loss on the part of the person who is acting out in the fashion that you described. They're afraid of being outshined. They're afraid that the boss is going to take favor over someone else's idea as opposed to theirs. And that is a loss of face, self-esteem, respect. And that is what's generating that. So the sooner that you, for example, use a label to identify that for the other person, the further along the path of mitigating that counterproductive behavior you go. Because even the aggressive bully who just can't seem to keep their mouth shut and seems to take over every team meeting that you have, they're telling you by the behavior that you don't get it. And the sooner that you demonstrate for them that you indeed do get it, the better off both of you are going to be, and the chances of you correcting, air quotes, that behavior becomes possible. Because it doesn't matter where they fall on the spectrum, assertive, analyst, or accommodator, everybody wants someone else to understand what they're going through. And this is good for all of you when you're talking about counterproductive behavior, persistent counterproductive behavior, because that's what was just described to me, because you said this happens often to this particular person. That is the counterpart jumping up and down screaming that you're not getting something. So when you're faced with any type of counterproductive behavior that's persistent, whether it's taking over meetings, being a bully, speaking with you aggressively, your challenge is to find out where it's coming from. And counterproductive behavior, the likes of which I just described, is done primarily for three reasons. You're missing something, that's reason number one. You're failing to be sensitive to something that's important to them. Reason number two, they're under tremendous pressure from somewhere on their side of the table, and you've failed to acknowledge it. Or they're doing it because they're trying to manipulate you or get over on you. You have to stay in the moment to figure out which one of those three it is. Because if it's the first two, nothing is going to get better until you address those negatives as they see it. If it's the third, if they're trying to manipulate, there's nothing in our playbook that says that you need to be victimized by manipulation. And so with persistent counterproductive behavior, you need to address it, because the longer that you let it go, the less influence you're going to have with the other person. In other words, if I repeatedly smack you in the face with a brick every time that we talk, I'm going to think to myself, Amber's just going to sit there and take it, so I'm going to continue to do it. And every time that I'm able to do it, your ability to influence me becomes less unless until the relationship just spirals out of control. Is that helpful, Amber?
Extremely helpful. Thank you very, very much.
And Sandy, what do you have to offer to our ladies in the audience today as far as executing late night FM DJ? What should they be aware of?
Be aware that you're not trying to have that sultry, sexy voice. For women, when you try to use that late night FM DJ voice, it can come across as overly sultry. So you want to make sure that you practice this a little bit. It's easier for the guys because it's easier for the guys because they don't have to worry about that so much. But for women, when you try to get that late night FM DJ voice, it can come down low and sultry. So you want to practice just having a calm cadence. It's not about having the low alto voice so much as it is just talking slow and enunciating each one of your words very clearly. If you want an example, watch Shark Tank and listen to Lori Grenier. She's the best at it for females for that late night FM DJ voice.
Now that's perfect. That's exactly right. The late night FM DJ, and as you heard it in Sandy's voice, because she just played a little bit for us, is much more about cadence than it is the pitch of how you sound. And so something to keep in mind when we execute this, the amygdala is listed up there. The amygdala is that caveman part of the brain that 75% of it is dedicated to negativity. Why is that important? Because we're all guilty of imagining ourselves walking into a negotiation to deal with the aggressive, sharp, cutthroat negotiator. That actual negotiator makes up only about 30% of the planet. However, we all imagine walking into the negotiation and dealing with that person. It's because of the amygdala. And so if you know people have a tendency to imagine they're getting ready to walk into a buzzsaw every time they walk into a negotiation, and you want to walk in and show confidence through an aggressive tone of voice, we want to walk in and show that confidence, right, with our business tone, we're feeding into that buzzsaw. And so, right, the amygdala is always present. It's always working. It always drives us towards negativity because if we're negative about stuff, we'll survive. If we're worried we might get burned, we won't get burned because we'll stay away from it. If we're worried we're going to get our head chopped off in a negotiation by a cutthroat, guess what? That's what we're going to avoid at all costs, and we'll be in a defensive posture the whole time. And so do we want to be the cause of that as well? Probably not. And so how do we show power in our voice? Power actually comes from deference and curiosity. The C in caviar stands for curiosity. Go into every negotiation assuming you have something to learn. We all are guilty of walking into a negotiation assuming we have something to teach our counterparts. That is what causes debate, argument, and leads to impasse. When we come from a place of genuine curiosity, trying to understand and executing tactical empathy to get there, that's what gets us to the place where we're no longer splitting the difference at the end of our deals. And so keep that genuinely curious mindset. It also is roughly impossible for us to be genuinely curious and angry and frustrated at the same time. Those emotions are far enough apart, it's hard to feel them at once. And so what helps us stay in our chair, genuinely focused on curiosity, will keep us from getting angry. Instead of, you shouldn't have said that because it doesn't warrant any data, that has no justification, it doesn't make any sense. And your mindset goes to, that's really an interesting point of view. I wonder what would make you say something like that. You will perform better as a result. And so, every day, just like today, you got three choices. You can choose to stay the same, you can choose to get better, or you can choose to get worse.